I'm very happy now to welcome Robert Knott. He is a journalist with the Santa Fe New Mexican. He is the author of several books. His newest one, in collaboration with Max Evans, is called Going Crazy with Sam Peckinpah and All Our Friends. Robert and Max Evans will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Sunday, the 19th of October at 3 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. And Dorothy over at Collected Works has been kind enough to have the premier book signing and event for Max and me. So I'm really delighted for Dorothy. And thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, what a pair of characters, Max Evans and Sam Peckinpah.
I know. I trust everyone knows Peckinpah's name still. He was
Everyone knows his name, but not even everybody knows his name.
Right, or his reputation. He was a film director from roughly the early 60s to the early 80s, died fairly young at a heart attack, had a very, very crazy life, pushed it to the limits, hell-bent for living and maybe hell-bent for dying. And if he's known today, it's for certain movies like The Wild Bunch, a fairly violent turn-of-the-century Western starring William Holden. A really beautiful picture from the early 60s called Ride the High Country. He did the original Straw Dogs, which was remade a couple of years ago. And a number of other pictures, The Life and Times, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid with Kris Kristofferson and James Coburn, shot in Mexico, set in New Mexico. A lot of flawed masterpieces, a couple of really beautiful pictures, and frankly a few flops, including Convoy, shot in Albuquerque with Ally McGraw. Max, who is an author and a cowboy, knew Peckinpah for about 22 years, the whole time Peckinpah was in Hollywood. And so this is really his memoir of his relationship with him and some of the other people who revolved around their world, as told to me.
It's an interesting thing, because the way Max Evans describes it, Max was a writer, storyteller. Peckinpah couldn't originate any story, but he was a master of rewriting stories and writing screenplays from stories that somebody else made up.
Really good observation. It's one of the things that I think frustrated Peckinpah, but it's also something that made him hold writers like Max in high esteem, because they could help him with stories. I think Peckinpah had a great visual eye, as per Max's view of him. And it's a personal view, too, by the way. It's more personal than talking about the films, although Max worked on one of Sam's films, The Ballad of Cable Hogue, shot up in Nevada. But he does pay that sort of homage to Peckinpah as a really better director than people think, but not always a really clever man when it came to originating ideas or stories. He needed help on stories. But Max does give him a lot of credit for rewriting on the set, which is not easy to do.
Yeah, I mean, as many writers say, the art of writing is in rewriting. But I love books like this, or I love this book, because it gives you that sense of what it actually takes to get a work of art made. Or maybe some of these were not what you would call great works of art, but to get a film made. And everything that can go wrong along the way. I mean, there are stories about films that started out with so much potential but were butchered.
Yeah, and Max does a good job of that also. I keep saying it's a personal memoir, but the truth is Max pays a really good amount of attention to Sam's career and how he was dealing with Sam as a friend while Sam was dealing with these problematic pictures. Major Dundee comes to mind, 1965. Cable Hogue, a picture everyone's forgotten called The Deadly Companions, which starred Maureen O'Hara and Brian Keith. That was Sam's first feature.
Now, did you watch all of these along the way? You must have.
I've seen every movie Peckinpah made except his last one, which is called The Osterman Weekend. There was really no point to watching it. I will someday, but and that's mentioned in this book too, because it was Sam's last gasp shortly before he died. Stars Burt Lancaster, who has a little cameo appearance in this book, a rather amusing one. And that's one of the things, real fast, I like about Max's book, is he does deviate from Peckinpah to talk about these old-time Hollywood people that he had encounters with when they were trying to option his work or deal with Peckinpah. Burt Lancaster is one of them. And there's amusing little stories about actors a lot of people may have forgotten, like Dale Robertson and Stuart Whitman. There's a whole chapter to a character actor named L.Q. Jones, who everyone has seen in movies. He's been around since 1955.
And we haven't probably heard his name or been aware of hearing his name, but he calls, Max Evans calls L.Q. one of the best character actors who ever lived.
Right, and said he had a career of 50, 60 years, and L.Q. is still living, by the way. He's a funny guy, tells great stories. So this was a long-developed and long-awaited work of love for Max, because he started working on this in the late 1980s, about 5 years after Peckinpah died of that heart attack. And it's just, he collected notes, he collected data, he collected interviews, and then asked me a couple of years ago if he could dictate it to me as a memoir as told to Robert Knott. So I really want to make it clear it's Max's story as told to me. I had very little hand in shaping it other than to make sure that the chapters were edited, fact-checking, and put them in order.
So what was that process like? How long did it take? What were your days like together? I imagine he was such a hard-drinking wild man.
Max.
Both of them. Both Max and Sam Peckinpah.
I was very lucky that Max stopped drinking shortly before we worked on the book, because I'd heard stories of other writers who've worked with him. And how, you know, a 12 noon first drink of the day.
That's what I was wondering.
Would last until about a midnight 22nd drink of the day. Max always insisted he never drank while working. And that's also something that I joke a lot at people at work. I say, I get, you know, tired at the New Mexico. I'm going over to La Fonda for a 4 o'clock beer. But I would never do that, really, on the job. Max and I would meet once a week, almost always on a Saturday, in Albuquerque, sometimes in his home. Sometimes we'd go out to one of his favorite restaurants. I used an old Sony tape recorder with a cassette tape. In fact, this was the last real job that 15-year-old tape recorder did for me, which made Max comfortable because he was he's not a technological guy. And he has sort of, I'm not sure if this is the right term, telekinetic powers, where he can turn off electronic machinery. He writes about that in one of his chapters.
With his mind?
He never used a computer. I mean, he's written so many books always on a typewriter, even up to the last one about 5 years ago before he dictated this one to me. I also took really copious and longhand notes while he spoke to make sure I covered myself. And he would dictate on a Saturday. I would almost always drive back, and that evening or Sunday morning, I would put together the notes in chapter form. So it was relatively easy to put the whole book together over time. And that took about a year, not every single Saturday, but I think we spent about 30 Saturdays putting together 25 chapters.
What are some of your favorite stories from this book?
And we didn't drink while we put it together. I meant to say that. We
had lunch meetings. You implied that.
We had iced tea. You know, you get afraid of telling these stories. I mean, you mentioned before we went on the air the one about the martini filled with, you know, ashtray residue,
yeah,
and somebody drank it. I mean, briefly, there's Max, you know, trying to kill Sam Peckinpah after Peckinpah pushes Max into a pool and Max can't swim. He's got cowboy boots on and he sinks and he breaks his ribs. There's a wonderful story about...
I mean, wait a minute. These people are... These people are working together. One of them gets mad at the other over a perceived insult, which wasn't even an insult.
It's friendship.
And then he literally tries to kill him by pushing him into a pool. The guy can't swim. He barely pushes himself back toward the edge, and he kicks his feet back into the pool and is only saved by the intervention of somebody else. And then afterwards, they go home and have a drink.
They do. And then the story continues in pretty funny fashion with Evans and the other guy stopping because they're too drunk to drive, which was smart, along the coastal highway. And Max goes to sleep in the car, and the other guy decides he wants to sleep on the beach, but to get to the beach, he has to go through a house. And it's just a stranger's house in the 1970s when the doors were open. And he walks through the front door of the house at midnight. The people are sleeping. He goes out on the beach through the back door. The dog follows him, barking. The people don't wake up. He sleeps on the beach all night. In the morning, he comes back, goes back through the house to the car parked out front. And only then do the owners wake up and realize an intruder's been in the house. I mean, you wonder about these stories. Could they have happened? But if any one of us has ever had a story like this happen to us, and we all have one wild story, maybe more, Max and Sam probably had 100 of these, and I feel like we've only captured about 24 of them, actually.
Right.
And there's also a great naughty story. I won't go into details of a certain movie star who let Max,
Anne Margaret.
Anne Margaret does pass through the book, interestingly. Let Max take a look at a beautiful naked female movie star who happened to be sleeping.
Oh, that's a different story. Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, these are great stories. They're naughty, and they should be celebrated.
They should be celebrated, and even though it's not all that long ago, it's such a different era. I mean, people wouldn't get away with any of this stuff anymore.
He tells a great story about going outside of a bar on the Sunset Strip around midnight on a Sunday, quiet night in just about any town, and he and Sam just start throwing beer bottles in the air, and they pull out a revolver, because both men were comfortable with pistols for different reasons, and they fired away at the beer bottles, missing both of them, most of them. And, the police never arrive. The parking lot shattered glass. I mean, these things happen. And,
right.
We want to believe they happened.
And now you go to jail for terrorism.
You'd go to jail for bare minimum, disturbing the peace, but certainly terrorism. He once said, I don't know how we got away with a lot of this. I'm going to use the word crap instead of the word he uses. They did pull off a lot of hijinks. And they were grown men. They were in their 40s.
Right.
But you get the sense of two frat brothers, you know, 21 years old, thinking that they're going to be alive forever.
There's one story where Sam Peckinpah has been fired. This is the story that I thought you were going to tell, because he had shot a nude scene with Anne Margaret, and he wasn't supposed to, but he did it anyway.
And this was typical of Peckinpah being a rebel and not understanding that his actions were sometimes hurting his own career. Even if he was artistically correct, he wasn't playing by the rules of Hollywood. There's always been rules of Hollywood. Always. All the great directors, those that fought it, Orson Welles comes to mind, Anne Peckinpah, they fought it so ferociously that they sort of started to stagger and they started to fail in their fights. Others adapted and managed to keep some autonomy. I would say John Huston is typical of that. Still others just went along with the system and weren't nearly as well known.
Right. So what happened in this story? He got fired and he calls Max Evans. Sam Peckinpah gets fired from his job and he calls Max Evans. And says, you got to take a cab out here and get on the lot before the gates close at 4.
Right, because Max would often, Max lived in Albuquerque and Taos at the time, but he went to Hollywood a couple times a year, in large part because of his relationship with Peckinpah to sell scripts. He often optioned things. The two things made with Max's name on them, by the way, are The Rounders and High Low Country, which are probably the novels he's best known for because they became movies. Coincidentally, High Low Country was shot here in New Mexico about 15 years ago with Billy Crudup and Woody Harrelson. Max has no idea why Sam wants him out at MGM. Max doesn't have a car in L.A., and he drives out to the lot with minutes to spare, and it turns out a couple of executives in suits are going to kick Peckinpah off the lot, and they're afraid to because he's a scary man. And Peckinpah's mad at them, so he convinces Max, we've got to do something to these guys, who have nothing to do with Peckinpah messing up his career there.
They
come up with this little scheme to scare them, by passing Max off as a New Mexico rancher and cowboy, which he was, who is going to use,
Bedeezers.
Yes, a tool to castrate
cattle
without hurting them, and so they set it up for these two guys, and they say we've got a pair of them right in the drawer here, and.
They just start talking about bedeezers and what bedeezers are.
And the guys get nervous, and maybe certain parts of their body are shrinking up as they're listening to the story. And Max says, hey, I got a pair right here in a drawer. Let's use them on these guys. And the guys take off because they're just two executives in suits, and they chase them down the hallway. And, of course, then the chase stops, and they cut off before the police arrive. There's a lot of stories about escaping right before the police arrive.
And the police may or may not have actually arrived
Correct.
In any of those cases.
That doesn't matter in the storytelling.
Exactly.
You know.
It's very funny. We're talking to Robert Knott about the book Going Crazy with Sam Peckinpah and All Our Friends. And another thing that I really like about the book, I mean, it was told to you, and it was told the way somebody talks, and so you can really hear the voice of the speaker so clearly.
I'm really pleased you said that because the praise I've received from the people who've read it, including Max's wife, Pat, because Max never did that before, when she said, my God, he captured your voice. Strangely enough, one publisher looked at the book and turned it down and said that it's clear that this is Max's voice and Robert hasn't been able to shake it. And strangely enough, we didn't want it that way. We wanted it to be the voice is heard as Max's. It really is 99% his. I did minimal editing on it and came up with some of the chapter titles. It's from UNM Press. I really have to praise them. They did a really thoroughly professional job. And they turned it around. I told them I wanted it out by the time of Max's 90th birthday in August of this year. And they came out about 2 weeks later, which was fast and damn good. Good job by UNM Press.
Excellent. Another thing I appreciate is how gracious and generous Max Evans is about giving credit to the other people in his life who are good directors, good storytellers, whatever they do well, including the things that he does well. He really is very spot on with his praise.
He's a very selfless guy who believes in praising the people around him. And I asked him once, did you ever meet anybody you didn't like? And he said, no. I got along with everybody. He had that simple charm of a cowboy, which people were fascinated by, people were attracted to. But there he was in Hollywood writing screenplays, writing novels continually, writing journalistic stories. He had a name. It was a cult name, maybe. People knew Max Evans. They know Max Evans still by his name, but they can't always, you know, they're thinking about how the bell is ringing in their head. So he had this strange sense of cowboy myth to him, combined with the integrity and the intelligence of a writer, of a literary man, who could talk writing as easily as he could talk, you know, Bronco busting at a rodeo.
It also really brings up questions that, stuff that I don't usually think about, which is, what does it take to write a Western? I mean, do you have to be a cowboy? And cowboys who are literate and can write stories or novels or screenplays are probably pretty few and far between.
And if you like Western movies, as I do, you tend to, over time, realize which ones are not particularly realistic. It doesn't change you from enjoying, say, Rio Bravo with John Wayne and Dean Martin from 1959. It's not really a very realistic Western at all. It's just a hell of a lot of fun to watch. But Max, as a real-life cowboy, could be very critical of Western movies because he did not like when they didn't capture the real life of a cowboy, who usually did not have a gun on his hip. They generally did not carry six guns. They might have had a rifle, but they weren't carrying a six gun like in all those pictures. And he felt Peckinpah really tried very hard to capture not just the realism, but the transition of men. The Western, unfortunately, is still seen primarily as a man's film medium. It's not necessarily realistic or honest or true or fair, but he didn't like it. He was really fascinated when Peckinpah captured the transition that men and, I guess, women were going through as the West changed and their lifestyle had to change. And I'm not going back to the late 1800s. I'm talking about the post-war years.
Yeah.
When the big ranches finally started to collapse under the weight of even larger ranch, you know, associations that would take them over, and the pickup truck replaced the horse taking the cattle down to the train.
Right.
And Peckinpah captured that transition. He captured men. He was much better, in my view, capturing the story of men on camera than women who were trying to figure out how to survive or frankly, outride this transition. And most of his movies are not exactly happy endings. It's kind of tough for the cowboys in his pictures. There's a couple exceptions to that. Junior Bonner, which is a terrific Steve McQueen picture, has a pretty upbeat ending, and that's a little rare.
We're talking to Robert Knott about the book Going Crazy with Sam Peckinpah and All Our Friends. Another thing that was changing was the film industry itself.
Right.
And that's documented to some extent, too. Like, for example, the way deals were made and packaged, that changed, and actually Sam Peckinpah blew a perfectly good deal because that kind of administrative part was in transition.
Peckinpah got into pictures in the mid-50s as an assistant director, dialogue director, bit actor. You can actually see him in a 1955 B-Western called Wichita, starring Joel McRae. That was the tail end of the studio system where stars were under contract for 7 years. So were directors, writers, etc. That doesn't mean it ended then. It took a long time for that old golden age of Hollywood to die. So Peckinpah comes on the scene as a feature director 61, 62, about the time Max first goes to Hollywood, about 2 years after Max wrote The Rounders, which was a big, big literary success in 1960, 61. And so that is the, it's really the tail end. Some of the old stars are still holding on, and yet the deals are changing. You now have to go through marketing a package with a producer, a director, a writer, the agent's getting 15%. And Peckinpah did not particularly like this, and he did blow a deal. He did not particularly like producers. He felt they interfered with his vision. He might have been right all the time. He might have been right half the time. It might be that none of us know how often he was right or wrong. So that was part of his challenge as he adapted to filmmaking. The truth is, I don't think Peckinpah would have done well with his personality in the 30s, 40s, or even early 50s, because he wouldn't have been able to pull that off. As I talked about, Orson Welles, to some degree, tried that and really failed many times. He certainly failed in terms of sustaining a great career as a director. And the story Max tells about a little TV pilot he came up with about a couple of cowboys who buy a gas station and are trying to run it in the early 60s. You know, it sounds a little bit like a combination of Andy Griffith and, a fun Western series, but Peckinpah managed to blow a deal that took months to put together in 10 seconds when he found out that there's going to be, you know,
somebody got 10%.
Everybody else is getting 10%. Yeah.
You kind of alluded to a story a moment ago about Burt Lancaster. Mm-hmm. Do you want to tell that?
You know, I think most people still know who he is. He was a great old-time star. Came up in the post-war years. Great performance in The Killers. Some terrific film noirs. He is the Crimson Pirate for anybody who remembers this wonderfully colorful, action-packed 1952 color pirate picture put out by Warner Brothers. Good actor. Sweet Smell of Success. Separate Tables. Birdman of Alcatraz. Elmer Gentry. The Professionals. He was a larger-than-life personality who could be really charming and funny, and he brought Max in to write a screenplay based on one of Max's books called The Great Wedding, which in a nutshell is about two old cowboys who one of them gets a scheme to marry off his best friend to a elderly widow because the buddy figures, I can then live on the ranch and do nothing while my friend here is taken care of forever. He's basically trying to pimp his buddy out. It's a very funny little novel. Lancaster wanted to do it and brought Max in for a conversation. I won't give away the punchline, which involves some swear words, by the way. But, you know, Max goes to meet Burt Lancaster in the mid to late 1960s, and he's still the Crimson Pirate. He set up a gym in his studio, and he's got his clothes on, and he's not stripped down to a pirate's outfit. Maybe he throws his jacket off, and he jumps on a trapeze bar and starts swinging from trapeze to trapeze with a young guy named Nick Cravat, who's a diminutive actor who worked with Lancaster in some of these pictures. And Max is just sitting there watching this scene, this surreal scene, while the walls of the gym are covered with great artworks that Lancaster had collected over the years and couldn't fit in his house. So there's little stories like this, little vignettes that are just strangely surreal, but you kind of can understand this mad world of changing Hollywood and how Max got to meet the new up-and-coming talent but was still sort of dealing with some of the guys that were on their way out. There's not a lot to say about John Wayne, but he did know him. He did try to put together a picture for Wayne. There's a funny little story in there about that around 1975. He had encounters with Henry Fonda, but he was really learning more and more about these character actors who were coming up to be stars. Warren Oates, of course, figures in the book. Steve McQueen was a hot star in the 70s. Lee Marvin, there's a great chapter on Lee Marvin. And Max knew Marvin before Marvin got an Oscar for a picture called Cat Ballou. And he really paints a really subtle, kind portrait of a man who changed very quickly once success and million-dollar paychecks came his way, without being cruel to Lee Marvin at all.
What was it like the very first time you and Max Evans sat down together to start this book?
I was a nervous wreck. I was really honored he had asked me. We met early in the year. He had asked me right before Christmas, and I told him I needed a couple of weeks to think about it, but I didn't even need 2 hours to think about it. And I went down to his house in Albuquerque. He sat down in an easy chair, and he put me on a couch, and I told you about that Sony tape recorder, old-fashioned. And I said, where can I plug this in? And he said, there's an outlet down there. He pointed to the right on the floor. I went to plug it in, and there was a pillow, and on top of the pillow was what I believe was a 9mm pistol, which is an automatic pistol that probably shoots 15 shells, I should know, as a former Air Force guy. And I did a double take, and I said, Max, you got a gun down here. And he picked it up, and he began waving it sort of indiscriminately around the room, very comfortably and with a great sense of cowboy humor. He said, oh, I just keep this in case burglars come in. This is one of six I have planted around the house. And I'm thinking, this is great. You know, if I don't do this job right, I'm going to get a bullet through the head. You know, one missed semicolon, and I become an obituary in the Santa Fe, New Mexico. So that was our first encounter, and I knew to be very respectful after that moment.
Robert Knott's book, in collaboration with Max Evans, is called Going Crazy with Sam Peckinpah and All Our Friends. And Robert and Max will be at Collected Works Bookstore at 3 o'clock this Sunday, the 19th of October. Thank you so much for being on the Radio Cafe, and thanks for this wonderful book.
It means a lot to me that you're plugging it. Thank you. I am going to say it's Max's book in collaboration with Robert Knott. I don't know whether we're going to read it all from the book. Max doesn't like that. We may just sit and talk with people. I believe Lorraine Mills is going to moderate a talk between us. Come by. Don't feel pressured to buy the book. Just come hear us. Real fast, a week after, we're down in Albuquerque. Buy the book. Thank you. We're in Albuquerque the following Sunday at Bookworks at 3 o'clock, and then we hit Lovington, New Mexico, and later Taos. So we're doing a few book signings around the state. And you can find it online. Look at UNM Press, Amazon.com, and thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And support your local bookstores.
Absolutely. Collected Works. Thank you, Dorothy.
And thanks, Robert Knott, for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, babe.